Okay, I'm sorry. I heard people talking. I thought it was from Everson Borough. I just want to come in. Okay. Okay. Next week there won't be a shiur. It's Hanukkah. And I also have to light candles. So.
Yeah, really? You do that? You have Hanukkah in your house?
Right.
Is it not enough to speak about it?
I have it in mine, too. Wow.
So I thought that instead of continuing with Pirkei Avos, we'll speak about Hanukkah. And we'll continue with Pirkei Avos in 2 weeks, Amir Sashem.
No Pearl next week, and then now there's no Rabbi
Lev.
Maybe we should tell Phil.
Yeah, I think I told my daughter, or my wife told my daughter one of the two. I don't have to tell anybody, everything I do now is known all over the world, so I don't have to say anything, just it's very scary. Okay, there is a significant difference between the Al-Hanisim of Hanukkah and the Al-Hanisim of Purim in their structure. They basically say different things, because one's for Purim, one's for Hanukkah. But they're the same prayer structurally, except for one word. See how it works. Hanukkah starts, Bimei Matisyo ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol, Chashmonei Abonav. We introduce the purity of time that this miracle took place, and who the tzaddikim were that were involved. Same thing with Purim. Bimei Mordechai ve'Esther, Bishushan Abira. We introduce the purity of time and who the tzaddikim were that were involved. Now we introduce the tzaddikim, okay, who were the bad guys. So, Kishomad Malchus Yovan Harishal Amcha Yisrael, when the Greek Empire rose up, and by Purim the same thing. Kishomad Aleim Haman Arasha. So now we introduce the good guys and the bad guys. What did the bad guys want to do that made a problem? So by Purim it says, Bikesh l'hashmid l'arogu l'abeit. He wanted to annihilate us. It should say the same thing now by Hanukkah. Bikshu l'ashgicham torasecha. They wanted to make us forget the Torah. It doesn't say that. It says l'hashgicham torasecha. It doesn't say they wanted to make us forget the Torah. It says to make us forget the Torah. Why is that word missing, the bikshu, what they wanted to do? So I think the answer is, the threat of Haman was created by what he wanted to do. The day before he wanted to annihilate us, he wasn't a threat. His threat became because of what he wanted to do to us. The threat of Yavan did not start when they wanted to do anything. When they had any designs actively against us, that wasn't the beginning of the threat. By the Yavanim, as soon as they became a world power, that in itself was a threat. Their influence was a threat to the Jewish people. The proof to that is, before they made any decrees against us, there were many Jews who succumbed to Greek culture and became Mishyavnim. So, you see that the threat of Yavan wasn't generated by what they wanted to do, but what they were. So now the question is, what were they? What was his threat? Yavan represented the externals of the world. The Maral explains that the three sons of Noah were the pillars of the development of the world society. And each one had a different aspect of society that came from him. Yethes, beauty, that was the externals of the world. You need a infrastructure in order to have a society. So you have to have a body, you have to have material possessions, you have to have the externals of the world. But the externals of the world are meaningless if you don't have a neshama to it. There's no spirituality. Shame represented the neshama of the world. In fact, the word shame is the middle letters of neshama. The inner part of the neshama. And Ham represented the drives, the energy, the appetites that move the body and the soul. And therefore, when Noah blessed his children, he blessed them accordingly. He said, Yaft Elokim li Yefes, God should enlarge or beautify Yefes, because they represent the externals of the world, and they should have large, beautiful externals. But the Yishkon Biole Shame, they have to have a partnership with shame, where they dwell in the tents of shame, because if they don't permeate the physical with spiritual, it's a dead body and it decays. So they have to be partners, shame and Yefes. With a soul without a body can't exist in this world. So they need to be together. Yefes will create the physical infrastructure of the world, the external beauty of the world, and shame will infuse it with holiness, spirituality. And Cham, the Canaan, Yeh Eved Lomo, Canaan, who was the epitome of Cham, has to be subservient, subjugated to Yefes and shame, because the drives and appetites, if they're not subjugated and subservient to the body and the soul, they will destroy the body and the soul if they're not under the control of the body and the soul. So that's how Noah saw the development of the world that would come from his three sons. If Yavon had wanted to fulfill their role and partnership it with shame, right, then that would have been fine. In fact, the Gemara learns from this pasuk, Yaft Elokim li Yefes v'yishkon bo li shame, that in the time of Chazal, you could write a Sefer Torah in Greek letters. You could take the beauty of the Greek alphabet and infuse it with the holiness of the Torah. But Yavon did not want that. Yavon denied any inner spiritual value to the world. Huh? Yavon is Greek, Greece.
The word for
right. They denied the validity of any inner importance of this world. They only saw the externals. And therefore they deified external beauty, external wisdom, only logic, no transmitted knowledge, Mesorah. They only believed in might and power, external might and power, bodybuilding or whatever. They worshiped the body. In fact, even their gods were basically human beings, just superhuman beings. They weren't spiritual beings. They were basically physical human beings with the same foibles as regular human beings, except super. I think the word Yavon represents that. Yavon is three letters, Yud, Vav, Nun. They're three lines that have no inside. They're just lines, external letters. In addition, when you look at the world from a totally material, physical standpoint, you evaluate it in quantity. When you look at the world from a spiritual standpoint, you evaluate it in quality. Not quantity, there's no quantities to spiritual, it's quality. From a physical standpoint, there are three generic quantities, small, medium, and large. That's Yavon. Three lines with no inside, small yud, medium-sized vav, large nun. Right? Three sizes of the physical world. In addition, those three lines are parallel. They never meet. There's no achdus. What gives some kind of unity in this world is a spiritual aspect. Physically, everything's separate. There's no unity, because everything has its specific physical limitations and borders. So Yavon is three letters with no inside that are parallel and come in the three generic sizes of quantity. In addition, Yavon spelt backwards is Noi, beauty. They took what real beauty is and totally turned it upside down, backwards, right, and made it only into external beauty. So that was Yavon. And they had a influence on the Jewish people. Basically, there are two ways of looking at the Torah. It says that the the weakness of that generation, why they were vulnerable to the decrees of Yavan, was because Nisrashnu Bavodas Hashem. They were derelict in service to Hashem. And that simply means the Beis HaMikdash, simple meaning. Right? They somehow were derelict in the service of the Beis HaMikdash, but I think it has a much deeper meaning. There's two ways of looking at Yiddishkeit. One is, Yiddishkeit is a bunch of rules. Do this, don't do that, and if you fulfill the rules, you're okay. The real way of looking at Yiddishkeit is not just doing God's commands, but serving the Ribbono Shel Olam by creating a personality, a lifestyle, that's Torah. Person's lifestyle has to be a Torah lifestyle. So the mitzvos are merely windows to understand that all-encompassing will of God that applies to a person's entire life. If you have to develop a Torah lifestyle, and the mitzvahs are the means to do that, the mitzvahs aren't just a bunch of things to do, and your lifestyle can be a secular lifestyle too. There are people like that. Basically, their goals, standards, values are secular, but they're frum. So they keep mitzvahs, but it doesn't affect their lifestyle, their way of living. Those people, I can't remember now who it was, one of the American rabbis, I saw a very nice quote from him. He said, I can't remember now who it was, Rabbi Hollander. So he said the following. He said, people who don't understand this idea that you have to develop a Torah lifestyle, but they're basically, their value standards are secular, but they're frum. They don't have 613 mitzvahs. They have 613 problems. Because every mitzvah is a conflict to their way of life. So they have to figure out ways to get around them, to whatever, because the mitzvahs are problems to them. The people of that generation, that was their weakness. They kept mitzvahs, but not within the framework of a Torah lifestyle. Okay, give you two examples of that from my experience. When I was a rabbi in Miami, before Pesach, right after Purim, people would come to me with ads from the Jewish press for cruises to the Bahamas for Pesach. And they would ask me to check it out if I, felt that it was okay. Kashrus-wise, Shabbos, Yontif. And my reaction was, you know, could be that from the four parts of the Shulchan Aruch, there's no problem here. It's glatt kosher, and there's no problem with Shabbos. But is that really what God wants you to do, right, on Pesach, to be on a cruise to the Bahamas? Maybe for Bahamas, but Bahamas? Not that there's anything wrong with going on a cruise. My wife would love to go on a cruise. I'm just afraid now that they'll catch me learning on a boat, too. If you need the relaxation, you want the fresh air, it's a vacation. There's nothing wrong with taking a vacation, and there's nothing wrong with getting some fresh air and entertainment and relaxation. But these people must have had more fresh air in their backyard in Miami than on a boat, without being seasick. Why in the world did they need this? Now, the answer is because it's a status symbol. Because this is a status symbol. You go on a cruise, status symbol in the Goyish world. So they wanted that status symbol. So you can be a glatt kosher Goy too, right? It's glatt kosher, but is this for Jews? Right? In another situation, had somebody, came to me once, very upset, a wealthy member of my kehila in Miami. When I first came to Miami, our kehila did not have a yeshiva in it. The day school was in Miami Beach. We were in North Miami Beach. You had to bus the kids for 45 minutes every day to school. We didn't have a mikveh in the community. You had to go to the mikveh in Miami Beach. And this man came to me very upset. He said, Rabbi, there is something bothering me. There is one thing in this that with our community is missing, that if we just would have it, we'd be a top-notch Torah community. And I was sure he was talking about a mikveh. So I was just waiting for him to tell me what that one thing was. And then I would say, look, if it bothers you so much, why don't you become the chairman of the mikveh committee and build a mikveh here? So with bated breath, I said to him, what is that one thing that our community is missing that would make it a top-notch Torah community? He said, a glatt kosher French restaurant. Like I was trying to figure out where the mikveh would be in this restaurant. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with a glatt kosher French restaurant. My expertise in French cuisine ends with French fries, but I'm sure there's more to it. That's not the problem. But you tell me, are some things our community is missing to be a top-notch cuisine French community? What does that have to do with Torah? But that's the idea. The standards are goyish standards. That's what a community is, good eating places. And the mindset has to be glatt kosher. So the Jews at the time, many of them, only saw the externals of Judaism, and the internal life was basically secular. So they were very much impressed and influenced by the externals of Greece. Because, honestly, the externals of Greece are much more impressive than the externals of Torah. They are bigger, stronger, more enticing, beautiful than the externals of Torah. But somebody who sees the internal beauty of Torah, so you'll excuse the pun, the Greeks can't hold a candle to the internal beauty of Torah. But the Jews who didn't see that internal beauty and only saw the externals, so they were influenced. And many of them were influenced to the point where they gave up Torah completely and became Hellenists, became Mishavnim. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam permitted the Greeks to make Xeros. He didn't cause them to do it. They had their reasons for doing it. They wanted all the nations they conquered to be with their way of life. Right? They wanted one united Greek way of life for all of the conquered places. They let each one have their own folklore, their own customs, but the way of life had to be Greek. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam didn't stop them. Why? Because when you don't appreciate something, the way sometimes the Rabbanu Shel Olam gets us to appreciate it is to have Goyim threaten to take it away from us or take it away. The nature of human beings is that when you have something, you take it for granted. When it's taken away from you, you want it back, and then you begin to appreciate it. Many people, unfortunately, don't appreciate their parents until they're no longer here. And then when they're not here, all of a sudden they kick themselves, oh, if I just would have appreciated my parents when they were here. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam permitted the Greeks to make these gzeiros. What were they? First thing, lashkicham torasecha, to make them forget the Torah. So the Sfarim say, not the written Torah. The written Torah you can't forget, it's there written. The main thing they were against was the oral Torah, which you can forget. Why? Because the written Torah is stories, folklore, external. The Mishnah, which is the oral Torah, is the osios of neshama. Because the Mishnah, the oral Torah, is the soul of the Torah and makes it a living thing, makes it a way of life. That they said, no, you can have your folklore, have your stories, have your books, because all nations have their folklore and their books, but not there should be a way of life. So forget the oral Torah, which turns those books into a way of life. And la'avira mechukei ritzonecha. You can keep your mitzvahs, some of them at least, but not make it a way that it's God's will, that it's a way of life. You can do it, just do it, do's and don'ts or whatever. Like, what's it called? Every nation has their folk customs, so you could have your customs. Don't make it a way of life different than our secular way of life. So those are the major two things, and therefore they make gzeiros against the following. One gzeira was against Shabbos, because Shabbos is the soul of the physical world. The physical world was created in 6 days, But the Rabbanu Shalom showed that those six physical days have an inner holiness that is represented by Shabbos. There's an Olam Haba that comes from this physical secular world. That's not the end. It's a means to reach an end. So Shabbos is the neshama of the physical world. Bris Milah represents the fact that the body is just a container for the neshama. But there's more to the body than just a body. There's a neshama there too. And Rosh Chodesh is the idea that time, Einstein said time is the fourth dimension. So we have the idea that there's more than just the body of the world, more than just the body of the human being, and there's more than just the body of time. You can infuse time with holiness. That's Rosh Chodesh. So they went against those three things, Shabbos, Bris Milah, and Rosh Chodesh. And the Rambam adds two other things based on Midrashim. Pashtu Yudeh B'mamonam. They went against Jewish money. They basically said, according to one Medrash, that anybody who owns any material thing, you own a tape recorder, you have to inscribe on it, Ein lanu chelik b'elokei Yisrael. Money is money. It has nothing to do with godliness. Right? So they separated the physical money, material possessions, from any connection to God. Nothing. What's it called? The money is the God. Right? They say it in America on the dollar bill. It says, in God we trust, but that is the God. So that and Bivnosam. And also they wanted to desecrate the holiness and purity of the Jewish family, of a Jewish woman. And they said that any woman, before she gets married, has to have relations with the Greek general of the place. And they didn't allow Taras HaMishpacha, they didn't allow a woman to go to the mikveh. And because Jewish women are a symbol of holiness, because the entire holiness of the Jewish people comes from women. Because if you have a Jewish neshama of holiness or not, depends on your mother. Your mother could be a plain, ordinary Jewish woman. Your father could have been Genghis Khan, but you're lamaisa, Jewish person. And your father could be Tzadik Gomor. But if your mother wasn't Jewish, you're not Jewish, unless you convert. So women are the symbol of the inner holiness of Klal Yisrael. And money, so that was the difference. These things they wanted to take out. No Torah Shebaal Peh, no oral Torah. That's the neshama of the Torah, otherwise just a bunch of stories, folklore. Take away a way of life of Torah. You could keep your customs, except for Shabbos, which represents the inner holiness of the physical world, Bris Milah, the inner holiness of the body, and Rosh Chodesh, the inner holiness of time, and against women, Jewish women, and Jewish money. Those were the things. So once there was a threat to have the inner values of Yiddishkeit taken away, Jews began to appreciate it. Like we said, when there's a threat to have it taken away, what you take for granted or don't appreciate when you have it, now they begin to appreciate it. And then the Rabbanu Shel Olam brought the Yeshua. Once they started to appreciate the inner value of Yiddishkeit, the Rabbanu Shel Olam then stepped in and now brought the salvation through the Chashmonoim, through the Kohanim, not through the kings and the warriors and the soldiers, because it wasn't the external might that was important, it was the internal, and that was the Kohanim. They were the ones who represent the internal holiness. And Chashmonoim hints to the fact that they had the power of all those things that the Greeks wanted to take away. They represented the power of those things. Ches is Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh. Shin, Shabbos. Mem is Mila, but it's also Mammon, money. Nun is Nida. Aleph is Eishes Ish. Those are the things that they made the decrees against, and those are the things that the Chashmonoim embodied to fight against them. And that's why in the Alanishim, that is basically the message of Hanukkah. There doesn't have to be a conflict between the external and the internal. They can work together, like we said, very nicely. But when there is a conflict, which one is the main thing? The inner, not the outer. That's what it says in the Alanishim. Masarta giborim biad chaloshim, the strong in the hands of the weak. Rabim biad miatim, the many in the hands of the few. Tameim biad tahorim, rishoyim biad tzadikim, vezeidim biad oskei sorasecha. So they ask, I understand it's a miracle if the few and the weak win over the many and the strong. But why is it a miracle if the righteous win over the wicked? Is there some kind of unwritten nature, natural law that righteous people always lose? And if they win, it's a miracle? Why is that included? The answer, I think, is very simple. It's not that the miracle was that the Greeks had the physical edge. They were many and strong. We didn't have that edge. We were weak and we were few. But we had a different edge. We didn't win because we were weak and few. We won despite the fact that we were weak and few. So why did we win? Because we had the spiritual edge. We were tzaddikim, we were pure, and we were oskei sorasecha. So when it came a conflict between the inner values and the externals, the inner values won out. That is the message of Hanukkah. The ikkar is not what is on the outside. The ikkar is what's on the inside. And that is exactly the miracle of the oil. It doesn't make a difference how much oil there is. But if it's pure, that's what makes a difference. That's this lesson of the menorah. In the Haftorah for Hanukkah, it says that God shows Zechariah the menorah, and he says, you understand what its symbol is? And Zechariah says, no, and God tells him, I'll tell you what the symbol of the menorah is. Lo bechayil ve'lo bekoach, it's not numbers and it's not physical strength. He in Baruchi, what makes the difference in this world is my spirit. That light of the menorah, that's the main thing. And that's the lesson of Hanukkah, right? And that's why the word gadol appears in the Alanishim of Hanukkah 5 times. And it doesn't appear once in the Alanishim of Purim. What does it say? Kohen gadol, ulecha asisa shem gadol, ulamcha Yisrael asisa teshua gadola, lahodos ulahale leshimcha hagadol. 4 times. 4 times says hagadol. Why? Because Yefes, the progenitor of Greece, was called hagadol. Because physically, they were the big, beautiful, strong. But what's real gadol? Real gadol is not the physical. The real gadol is what's spiritual. That's real godless. What's really what's big and important? The kohen gadol, right? Kohen gadol. They didn't weigh all the kohanim and measure them, and the biggest, fattest kohen was the kohen gadol. It had nothing to do with his size. It had to do with his inner spiritual value. I remember growing up in Miami, we didn't see Gedolei Yisrael, right? There were no big rabbonim like in New York that you could see Rav Moshe Feinstein or Yaakov Kamenetsky in those days. So I grew up in North Miami Beach. I never saw Gadol b'Yisrael. So when I spent my first Ben Hazmanim in Tells as a 17-year-old in New York, so I told my friends, take me to see Rav Moshe Feinstein. I want to see what the... So he took me to the Lower East Side, and they point out to me, like 2 blocks down, you see that person? That's Rav Moshe Feinstein. I remember thinking to myself, that's Rav Moshe Feinstein? He came up to my shoulders, maybe, when I was 17. A little guy. I said, my God, if those are the Gedolim, what do the Ketanim look like? But he wasn't a Gadol because he was tall and fat. He wasn't a basketball player. He was a Gadol because of his inner greatness. That's what greatness is. That's Gadol. So the Alanisim of Hanukkah portrays that. You want to know what Gadol is? Gadol goes by spiritual terms, not by physical terms. It's not quantity, it's quality that makes the difference. And that's what we basically say when we sing Mo Sur. Mo Sur speaks about all the empires. that were no longer exist, right? There was Bavel, and there was Paras, and there was, what's it called, Yavon, and they're in the history books. They're not standing by candles singing about us. They don't exist anymore. And they have everything going for them. They had land and power and armies and money, and they don't exist anymore. And we had none of that. And we're singing about them. Why? Because we had that light of the candles. We had that inner spiritual, that power of Torah, which enabled us to overcome all of that. So it's not those things that they have that's the ikkar. It's what we have is the ikkar. That is the message of Hanukkah. The message of Hanukkah is what we have, that inner value. And that inner value is the Jewish home. That's why Hanukkah, the ikkar, is the home. You don't, what we light in shul is only a minig. You don't fulfill your mitzvah by lighting in shul. You have to light in the house. And the house, the woman, is the ikkar of the home. Because that is what Hanukkah is all about. And that's why not only did we get back what they decreed, we even have it greater, because now we appreciate it more, because it was threatened to be taken away. So think about it. Every Hanukkah has in it all the things the Greeks wanted to take away. It's 8 days like Mila. It has Rosh Chodesh in it. Rosh Chodesh Teves is always in Hanukkah. It has at least one Shabbos, sometimes two. So Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Mila. It has money, because Hanukkah geld is a minig to give Hanukkah geld, money. And women have a special place in Hanukkah. They don't do work during the time that the candles are burning.
Man likes them.
Yeah, okay, but Lamaisa, the women have a special connection to Hanukkah too, right? The man likes it because he is the balabais, right? But in our home, our daughters also lit, right? It depends on custom. Some places they do, sometimes not. But they, even though they may not light the menorah, they're the ones who have the connection to it, but they don't do malacha.
Mishtatef.
What? Mishtatef. Right, whatever. They don't have to mishtatef even. They're part of the family. It's just all one unit. By some, only a guest has to be mishtatef. But people in the family itself, not.
The man has no obligation. The man doesn't like Shabbos candles.
The what? Right, okay. That's, yeah, right, right. That's a special reason, though, because of Shabbos. Because of Challah, she put out the candle of the world. Yes or no? In any case, just as a siyum to this, when I first came to Eretz Yisrael 36 years ago, so the things were different here, a lot different. And the culture, society, socially, was very different. Israeli society and American society. Now they brought most of America here, so most of American society is here now. Even Israelis understand it. But then, it was completely different. I mean, even American products didn't exist here. People used to bring on their Lift, Starkist tuna, and Hellman's mayonnaise, and breakfast cereals, because they didn't exist here. But once a year, they had American Day in Supersol, and they brought in American products. I remember one year, my wife bought, during this American week in Supersol, she bought Quaker oats for cereal. It has a picture of a Quaker on the... But you see our children who grew up here had no idea of anything. So they, what's it called? My wife brought home the cereal. My daughter comes to me after davening, little, she was maybe 5-6 years old. She says, "Mommy, just brought cereal with the Kalava Rebbe on it." So they have no idea what's it called. Right here also, they still have no idea. They dress up on Purim as Santa Claus. They have no idea who it is, what it is. Yeah. The Beis Yaakov near my home, I hear that the music they're playing between classes is Jingle Bells.
Oh my gosh.
They have no idea what it is. In any case, so one of the shocks came Hanukkah time. Because in America, anywhere in Chutz La'aretz, the food of Hanukkah is latkes. Right, for sure. Here, they had a first Hanukkah party, no latkes. What do they have? Jelly donuts. What in the world's jelly donuts have to do with Hanukkah? It was really a culture shock. Second day, no latkes. Finally, this is the middle of Hanukkah, I was passing by the army base near our home, this gigantic billboard with one word on it, an arrow pointing towards the army base, latkes. So I said, at least in the army, they preserve the custom of eating latkes. The person tells me, don't get carried away. That says latkes. So, but after thinking about it, the Israeli way is more significant. Why do we eat latkes? Because they're made in oil. So it's a remembrance of the miracle of the oil. I'm sure that if you would take a latke and put a wick in it, it would last for 8 years, not for 8 days. So you say the same thing about jelly donuts. They make the donuts in oil. But there's something much more significant about jelly donut. Jelly donut tells you it's not on what's on the outside that's the ikker. It's what's on the inside. That is really the lesson of Chanukah. Okay, so we'll have a freilich and Chanukah, and we'll see you, Yerzh Hashem, afterwards.
Go ahead.